But frankly, I have seen those arguments. I don't spend much time on it because it doesn't matter at all. Even if that case means nothing, and it is a case, not a law. There were two cases in, I think it is 1888 and 1889 or 1890. One is the Pembina mining case, I believe, and I think one is the Minneapolis and St. Louis or something like that railroad case. And they're in at least two of those books referred to. Those two cases clarified and consolidated the decision. So it doesn't really matter whether the 1886 Santa Clara decision was totally goofed up or not. So it's definitely there in the precedents. And after those further two cases in the late 1880s, it's been affirmed and assumed and cited in almost every case since then. So we have a big job on our hands, but it doesn't involve just that one case. It involves all the precedents set in those few years, then how they've been applied, and frankly, they're now written into law. So that's the first question. Second one, the money equals speech thing. After the Nixon election in 1972, there were a lot of calls for reform in the system of presidential elections. And out of that came a campaign law, which is essentially the law, I think it's Federal Election Commission Act of 1974, I think. Out of that law essentially legalized PACs, political action committees. It legalized them. And then there was a court case in 1976, Buckley v. Valeo, I believe, which is the one that essentially set in place the money equals speech thing. Now, I've read that case. It's almost 300 pages long. And I don't know, there are like 50 or 80 different points. And each of the justices had a different opinion on at least five of the points, and they all wrote it down. So it's incredibly complicated. But it's not just about money equals speech. It's also about political parties. And I think you find in that case the key to why is it so difficult to have an independent or a third party? Well, a lot of it was because, frankly, the Republicans and the Democrats did agree on some things, and that is, for many, not all of them, that third parties are a real pain in the neck. So that's a really complicated case, but I still find that most of the discussion that arises from it is on sort of narrow grounds. You know, money equals speech. Well, how much money is too much money and too much speech, and can someone's spouse give $2,000 or $1,999, and it doesn't have to be before April or before this, and distracts us from large questions like, how can we run elections so that any adult has an equal opportunity to be heard and be part of the debate? Isn't that what we want? Not just people who are either very well-connected or very well-off, which frankly is what we have now, except in very local elections. Anyone who's like a working-class person has hardly a chance. Okay, so that's what the essay in that. Give me the book so I can flail them around again. The essay in here, and it's available elsewhere, called us "Speaking Truth to Power About Campaign Reform," tries to just broaden the question. We need to talk about. Let's pretend we don't live in the world we live in right now. If we wanted to stage an election in Madison or Dane County or Wisconsin and have it be good and fair. And have everyone have an opportunity to be heard, how would we go about doing it? And that's a question that goes far beyond public financing, which just to light another fire here. I personally, and I think most of the people in the program on corporation law and democracy, are opposed to public financing of elections. Gasp. And I'll tell you why. And the reason is because they don't address very many of the problems with elections. But even more importantly, once you get beyond the local level, do you know where about 80% of the money in elections is spent, where it goes?
Broadcast.
It goes to TV, which, as you know, we're not having a real debate on. And the corporations that run those things jack up the prices at election time. So essentially, it's like a giant vacuum cleaner from all the taxpayers paying 80% of that money to the same corporations who are playing a huge role in us not being able to have better discussions. So on the money and equal speech thing, in the interest of having everyone get to express themselves, I'm just going to say that I think it needs to be much broader than it's been painted in the last couple decades of court decisions on it.
You've just heard a discussion on corporate personhood by corporate anthropologist Jane Ann Morris and author of the book Gaveling Down the Rabble, How Free Trade is Stealing Our Democracy.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. During her talk, Jane Ann Morris mentioned two books, Define Corporations, Defining Democracy, and Globalized Liberation. It so happens that both of those books are on my bookshelf, and I'm going to commit to reading those to you over the coming year. Of course, you could read them yourself, just as you could do the research on the topics I present on this show yourself, eliminating the necessity of this show. I'm defining my service to you here as doing something for you so that you can save that time and effort and apply it elsewhere. The wonderful thing about having someone read to you is that it leaves your body free to perform the wide variety of mostly mindless but essential chores we all have to do, and hopefully make them less boring and odious. So I'm going to start with the book, Define Corporations, Defining Democracy, a book of history and strategy. This book was published in 2001, and it's a collection of articles by a variety of people and edited by Dean Ritz. HOCLAD, the program on corporations, law, and democracy, of which Jane Ann Morris was a part, is responsible for getting the book out. It begins with this quote, "No culture can be realistically and effectively analyzed. No culture can be realistically and effectively analyzed by those who elect to leave its central idols untouched. And a fundamental change is required. It does no good simply to landscape the ground on which these idols stand." Robert Staunton Lind, Knowledge for Who, 1939. This is a preface by the editor. Section 1. Popular sovereignty. All political power is vested in and derived from the people. All government of right originates with the people, is founded upon their will only, and is instituted solely for the good of the whole. Section 2. Self-government. The people have the exclusive right of governing themselves as a free, sovereign, and independent state. They may alter or abolish the constitution and forms of government whenever they deem it necessary. The above defining language is from the constitution of the state of Montana, where I live. It's exhilarating language, if you believe it to be true. It is the language of sovereignty, of self-governance. It states ideals which people fought to advance, gave their lives to protect. It makes one think that anything is possible if only we the people decide to put ourselves to the task. Well, why not? Several years ago, I encountered this why not. At the time, I was immersed in my career, working for large corporations, advising them on licensing technology, their intellectual property, negotiating on their behalf their intangible property, and developing strategies to maximize future profits, their imaginary property. I was enmeshed in the protection and extension of the power of corporations. I just didn't know it. I came to know it when I was introduced to the work of the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, POCLAD, including many of the articles contained in this collection. In these articles, I came upon questions, ideas, histories. I was provoked to learn more, to observe more closely, to identify the assumptions behind the nature of my work and of my worldview. Going through such a process, one can't help but be transformed. Some of my values were reinforced, others refined, and then others were completely rejected, with new ones defined to take their place. This book, Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy, is a challenge to imagine and then define a future, rather than take the one which has been imagined for us by slave owners, by the Pennsylvania Railroad Corporation, by ExxonMobil Corporation, Disney Corporation, Dow Chemical Corporation, and Microsoft Corporation. It is a book dedicated to the ideals of self-governance, of universal human rights, and respect for the Earth's natural systems, of which people are only a part. Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy brings together a dozen authors' unique experiences and perspectives from decades of civic activism. Poclad's journey in research, analysis, arguments, thoughts, provocations, and actions is instructive and genuinely inspiring. This journey reflects the work of small groups everywhere, of people's struggles in their communities to understand what's going on, who rules their communities, and how self-governance may be practiced. When one reads the language of the Montana Constitution, similar in its aspirations to many states' constitutions, two points are clear. First is that it describes an unrealized ideal. The second is that such an ideal is worth working for. As you may know from reading the history of people's popular movements, each generation must engage in this process of examination, imagination, and of definition that self-governance and sovereignty will remain a myth if people are unable to define their institutions of government. Today, we live with this myth. Corporations today act in the capacity of governments. Energy corporations determine our national energy policies. Automobile corporations determine our nation's transportation policies. Military manufacturing corporations determine our nation's defense policies. Corporate polluters and resource extraction corporations define our environmental policies. Transnational corporations determine our trading policies. And the wealthiest among us, with their wealth deeply rooted in corporations, determine our tax policies. Corporations are armed with, quote, free speech, managerial prerogative, due process, equal protection, the commerce clause, the contracts clause, and all the lawyers, lobbyists, and bipartisan, spelled B-U-Y, support that wealth can buy. With all of this at their disposal, corporate leaders increasingly define our culture, our schools, our elections, and the operations of our government itself. Defying corporations is one part of the equation for achieving self-governance. That is, challenging the legitimacy of corporations to act in the capacity of governments. Defining democracy is another part of the equation. What do we mean by democracy? What kind of democracy do we have? What form of government is appropriate to our needs today and with respect to the future? Answering these questions and working towards alternatives is hard work. Is it worth doing? Why, of course. Finally, we must free our minds to think beyond the institutions and futures imagined for us. The work of Poclad changed what I see, know, think, and now do. It has given me new sources of personal energy, optimism, and aspirations. It's my hope that your engagement with the ideas in this book will bring similar good fortune to you, Dean Ritz. And that's the preface from the editor of Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy, a book of history and strategy. Introduction. Engage us. We invite you to engage us in this idea. Giant corporations govern. In the Constitution of the United States, they are delegated no authority to make our laws and define our culture. Corporations have no constitutions, no bills of rights. So when corporations govern, democracy flies out the door. This may be a depressing idea, but it is not a new one or a complicated one. President Franklin D. Roosevelt, among others, spelled it out, quote, "The liberty of a democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of private power to a point where it becomes stronger than their democratic state itself. That, in its essence, is fascism. Ownership of government by an individual, by a group, or by any controlling private power," close quote. There is something else. When people live within a culture of privatized power, common sense scrambles out the window. People cease to trust their eyes and ears, to rely upon their own experiences. Their minds become colonized. How else to explain that our justice system treats corporate assaults upon life and democracy, such as pouring millions of tons of toxics into air, water, and food, denying Bill of Rights protections to employees, as legal, or that the New York Times Corporation really ran this headline in April 1998? "Times have changed. Corporations champion free expression." To understand the illegitimate authority by which corporations govern, people need to talk about it. To challenge this authority effectively, activist groups need to debate the different perspectives, goals, and strategies from those we're used to. For the past few years, the program on corporations, law, and democracy has been provoking such debates. Valiant organizing, early morning doubts. Let's start with what we and you have learned. Thousands of groups know how to stop an incinerator, organize a union, block a timber harvest sale, decrease a toxic emission, orchestrate a referendum or initiative, enact a new permitting and disclosure regulation. People spend years getting regulatory agencies to lessen a single corporate harm. But sometimes, in the darkness before dawn, you have wondered why, despite all this good activist work, corporate assaults against life and democracy keep increasing. After a century of local, state, and federal regulatory laws, pure food, labor, stock exchange, clean water, clean air, public health, why do people in community after community have to struggle for years to get the right to know what corporate chemicals are killing their families? To bring a wrongful damage suit against a corporation? To save a forest? To get a fair collective bargaining election? To get back pay or their own pension money? We all know stories about small, low-budget groups stopping global corporations from siting a deadly factory, clear-cutting a forest, ramrodding through a new law, busting a union, using deceptive advertising, carrying propaganda into a school. This is vital. Valiant and persistent organizing has enabled people to stand up to raw power and violence. It has bettered the daily lives of millions, instilled confidence and self-respect, transformed whole communities, taught democracy. But when the joy of victory fades, imperial corporations remain. Slowed down in one place, they pop up in another. They are in everybody's yards, front and back, in little leagues and scouting, in town halls, state houses, and Congress. They keep blocking sane, logical transitions in food, energy, transportation, healthcare, finance, forestry, and manufacturing. They keep funding think tanks and university corporations to frame public debate. They keep buying obedience and defining family values. Their leaders still walk off with big money and top community honors. Unimaginable billions of tax-deductible corporate dollars still gurgle through corporate public relations, advertising, and law firms, radio, television, magazines, and movie corporations keep selling their relentless message. Corporations, efficient, good. Government, wasteful, bad. Giant corporations bully and browbeat. They denounce people like you and us as Luddites, commies, tree huggers, and 60s leftovers. They homogenize people into consumers. They turn life into corporate theme parks. They also manipulate our government. It's nothing personal, of course. It's just that when they turn our own government against us, bureaucracies and courts and police and military paid with our money, they make us into the king's subjects all over again. But the United States got rid of the king a long time ago. We are supposed to be self-governing people. You know, we the people. Poklad evolves. During the early 1990s, some of us began to research and write about corporate, legal, and movement history. We started convening Rethinking the Corporation, Rethinking Democracy meetings. In 1995, we formed Poklad. Among other things, we realized that in our prior work, we had limited our goals and generally restricted our efforts to regulatory and administrative arenas. This was also true for many people's organizations. Yet corporations never limited their design and activities to anything. A century ago, corporate strategists began to dream up regulatory laws and agencies to replace the chartering processes, general incorporation laws, and state constitutions, which people had used to define corporations as subordinate. They transformed once potent public cultures of trespass, nuisance, liberty, and personal property rights into bastions of private corporate power. Perhaps you remember thinking this about your past campaigns. If only we had gotten 1,000 more letters in the mail, more experts at the hearing, better press coverage, more people at the demonstration. We remember, but now we see that even with these if-onlys, corporations would still be in charge. This is because the political and legal culture has been diverting activists from political arenas where people can define issues and make the rules, where whether we win or lose, it is clear that the struggle is about who is in charge, corporations or people. So today, Poklad is exploring different organizing arenas and reaching for the strategies that take into account long-time corporate influences over culture, law, and even activist organizing. We have intensified our examination of the great colonizer of the 20th century, the large business corporation. We've tracked its development from a subordinate legal entity created to serve the public good into a fantastic shield for property and wealth. We've helped people see how corporations got courts and legislatures to deny the rights of people and nature via doctrines and laws asserting that the corporation is a legal person, has property rights in decision-making, is forever. Our inquiries keep leading us to the activists in every generation who perfected organizations to advocate human rights over property rights, to repel their era's aggressions against democracy. These were people who understood that they could never practice self-governance and enjoy political liberty if they let legislatures, courts, and culture define corporations as beyond the authority of the sovereign people. Relationships, questions. Poklad's exchanges with activists started with a focus on corporations. Discussion quickly expanded to include governance and democracy, unleashing a torrent of questions. What should be the legal, political, and cultural relationships between people and corporate bodies? Who decides? How are a minority of natural persons in the original 13 states able to define the majority of human beings as non-persons? To define Africans as property, Native peoples as invisible, given that Native peoples, women, African Americans, immigrants, debtors, people without property, gays and lesbians, are still organizing for justice and equality, how did corporations become super-duper legal persons a century ago? Should people dismantle giant corporations, transform them? Should a business corporation be regarded as a citizen, as private? Should it have free speech? Are there constitutional rights differences between the NAACP and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, between the Sierra Club and the Chemical Manufacturers Association or the Tobacco Institute? Why does the General Motors Corporation have more rights than the United Auto Workers Union? What is property? Who decides if it's public or private? How did other generations decide? How did corporate leaders get their decisions on investment, production, and jobs to be regarded as private? How much legal and moral liability should shareholders bear beyond their own investments and consciences? What roles did railroad, banking, mining, and other corporations play in the federal government's abandonment of freed women and men of the South, in the writing of the Southern states' apartheid constitutions, in the exploitation of Native people, of immigrants from Asia and the global South? Who were the Knights of Labor? What did they have to say about railroad, banking, grain and telegraph corporations? About the control of knowledge? Who were the populists? Why did they risk their farms and jobs to stop the corporation from becoming the dominant institution in the land? What happened to them? Who were the progressives? Why did they concede that giant corporations were inevitable and settle for making them a little less dominant? Why didn't antitrust laws and all that trust-busting of Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson fix everything? Did antitrust fix anything? Why were regulatory and administrative agencies like the Interstate Commerce Commission, the Food and Drug Administration, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the National Labor Relations Board, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration created? Who wanted them? Why? Was there anyone who wanted something else? What is this country's plan of government? How is each generation supposed to discover it, to live it? Why didn't Tom Paine encourage people in colonial times to search for a more socially responsible king? Do famous phrases like "we the people" and consent of the governed mean anything? Why do environmental laws regulate environmentalists? Why do labor laws regulate unions? The time is ripe. Millions of people have organized courageously against corporate assaults of the legal and culturally accepted kind and of the illegal and culturally rejected variety. This is as it should be. As Eugene Debs has noted, if it were not for resistance to degrading conditions, the tendency of our whole civilization would be downward. After a while, we would reach the point where there would be no resistance, and slavery would come, close quote. Thousands of activist groups are flourishing. People from all walks of life have taught themselves to demystify complex issues and their special language. Chemistry, biology, physics, nuclear energy and weaponry, genetic engineering, global finance and trade, civil rights and human rights law, regulatory and administrative law. After two centuries of struggle, the formerly dissed and disenfranchised have gained the legal status of persons. In recent years, many have invested time and energy exploring identity politics. That means that even as corporate persons can create grotesque shadows across a disfigured cultural landscape, there is finally a multitude of human persons who can envision ripening into a self-governing people. It is now possible to direct organizing struggles beyond lessening the impacts of endless corporate assaults. Isn't it time? Today's giant corporations are not fundamentally different from what they were in the 17th century when King James of England chartered the Plymouth Company for the planting, ruling, and governing of New England in America. We believe the community, labor, environmental justice, and other organizations formed over past generations to resist harmful corporate behaviors are well positioned to take these logical next steps. How to press forward in the years ahead? That is what we want to consider with you. Challenging corporate authority to govern. POCLAD is not building a big national membership operation. Rather, we are working with existing groups to launch democratic insurgencies to render corporations subordinate. We are looking for people to invest time, energy, and resources challenging judicial doctrines, dealing with the Commerce Clause, personhood, the business judgment rule, the prudent man rule, managerial prerogative, and corporate property rights. People who fancy extending the Bill of Rights to employees on company grounds, amending state corporation codes to end limited liability, and to ban corporations from owning other corporations, excluding business corporations and their trade associations from elections, lawmaking, education, and public debate over community values, legal philosophy, and policy. Activists will need to do what corporate strategists have mastered: exploit the tensions of our federal system by creating crises of jurisdiction and authority between local, state, and federal governments. All this and more will happen as communities reject the idea that business corporations are private, as municipalities enact local ordinances defining corporations within their jurisdictions, as organized people instruct elected representatives to cease siding and abetting corporate rule. Conspire with us. We see ourselves as instigators and provokers, as conveners and facilitators. Our work is to help organizers challenge the mass producing and mass marketing of culture and law by artificial entities called corporations, to help people contest the authority of corporations to govern. And that introduction from the members of POCLAD, who were Bill Bockley, Greg Coleridge, Karen Coulter, Mike Ferner, Richard Grossman, Dave Henson, Peter Kelman, Ward Morehouse, Jane Ann Morris, Jim Price, Virginia Rasmussen, and Mary Zepernick. Starting point. Corporations cause harm to life, liberty, and property every day. Most corporate harms are considered legal because corporate harm doing is enabled and protected by law. Millions have organized courageously to prevent these harms or staunch their effects, but the harms keep coming, increasing in frequency and magnitude. Why are we the people always on the defensive? What do we need to know in order to see that even when we the people win one defensive battle against a corporation, we are closer neither to winning the next nor to implementing our own vision of health, energy, food, monetary, military, trade, election, investment, technology, and other policies. What do we need to do to make those policy decisions, to define our community's values? Assessing our knowledge in the context of our experience is our starting point. And our first article is by Jane Ann Morris, whose talk you heard at the beginning of the program. It's titled, Help, I've Been Colonized and I Can't Get Up. Take a lawyer and an expert to a hearing and call me in a decade. A third of your friends are locked down in an old growth grove or at a corporate headquarters with law enforcement officers rubbing pepper spray in their eyes. Another third are preparing testimony so you can be persuasive at a government regulatory agency hearing while you're begging them to enforce a tiny portion of our laws. The third are trying to raise money to pay lawyers to get your friends out of jail after they've been released from the hospital, or take the regulatory agency to court after it declines to enforce the law. The pepper spray, groveling, and money grubbing might not be so bad if we could honestly say that the earth is better off today than it was 4 years ago. I can't honestly say that. This diatribe is an effort to take a hard look at what we're doing and insinuate some new elements into the debate. It's not intended to belittle any of our efforts, point fingers, or assign blame, so don't take it personally. We are all earthlings. Our campaigns follow the gambling addiction model. The last bet didn't pay off, but the next one might if we just had a new, improved tripod, three more experts, more labor or church support, 10 more elected officials on our side, 100 more people at the demo, or 1,000 more letters in the mail. Who are we kidding? We are just doing the same old thing over and over again and fooling ourselves that it might work next time. We're stuck in a feedback loop where our failures are interpreted as signs that we should repeat our failed tactics but try harder. This is what it is to be colonized. The telltale sign is not that we're failing, but that we're fooling ourselves and don't see it as a feedback loop. If our minds are not colonized, then how come almost every Earth First Journal action piece starts with a banner or lockdown and ends with a plea to write a letter to a white male big shot? Go ahead, look through back issues. It goes on for years and years. Over at corporate headquarters, they have a steeper learning curve. Despite the occasional bag of guts on the committee table or clever banner, it must be reassuring for corporate executives and those who serve them to sit back and smile at the success of their containment efforts and the predictability of our campaigns. The issue of whose minds are colonized is a delicate one. We all know people whose minds have been colonized. Who are they? They are other people, people out there. They are somebody else, not us. It's time we did the unthinkable and asked ourselves if we have been colonized. What do we see when we compare our strategies to corporate strategies? Many of our groups are organized to save wolves, butterflies, trees, prairie flowers, rivers, deserts, or estuaries. The corporate executives don't organize to destroy the wolves, butterflies, flowers, estuaries, nor do they organize to pollute the air, spoil the rivers, or promote five-legged frogs. This asymmetry should give us pause as we try to understand why corporations are on a roll while we're stuck in a feedback loop. Let's look again. corporate strategy leverages their power. Their efforts reinforce and magnify each other. Our strategy splits our resources and dissipates our power. Corporate strategy aims to increase the power that corporations have over people. That means that when a single corporation gets a victory, it helps all other corporations too. They are all stronger. They all have more power, and the people have less. We work on separate harms. When we lock down to one old growth stand, others go unprotected. When we protest about one chemical, others go unprotested. When we testify to preserve one watershed, others are not spoken for. We have whole campaigns directed at one chemical, one corporation, one species, one grove of trees, one article of clothing. In doing so, we fracture our resources. While we're not working on a chlorine is bad or wolves are good campaign, we're not working on all the other chemicals, animals, trees, etc. that also need attention. Some of us argue that this fracturing is inevitable because there's so much wrong in the world. Declaring a problem to be inevitable is a great way to justify not talking about it. Another gift to the corporate worldview. Others of us think that the fracturing results from not being organized enough or not being organized right. This opens the door for endless bickering about whether we should organize by bioregion or by article of clothing, by species or by chemical, by issue or by occupation. Either way, we're still fractured. Being fractured is another way of being colonized. Another sign of being colonized is when you censor yourselves and don't even wait for others to do it. Some of our self-imposed limitations are right off of a corporate wish list. We have a strange, but it's the law syndrome. Why can't we bring up important issues at EPA hearings? It's regulatory administrative law. Why can't we get our views presented on TV? It's corporate private property law and FCC regulations. Why can't we imprison corporate executives for what their corporations did? It's liability law. So what do? We toe the line at the EPA hearings. We dress up as animals to get a moment on TV. We let lying corporate executives lie. That is, we work around the defining laws that are the groundwork for a rigged system. We're looking for favors, lucky breaks. We don't even dream of control, yet we call this a democracy. That is being colonized. Corporation representatives do not feel constrained in this way. Nothing is too destructive, too audacious, too outrageous for them to attempt. After all, they have most of us believing and not even objecting to the idea that corporations have rights. In early 1988, an association of corporations, itself a corporation that supposedly has free speech rights, according to one prevailing legal opinion, sued a talk show host in Texas for saying that she's going to stop eating hamburgers. Then there's the zen of describing the problem. We need our storytellers. We need our scribes. We need our analysts. We need our own human fonts of crazy ideas. We need Silent Spring. By now we have the equivalent of son of Silent Spring, daughter of Silent Spring, second cousin, once removed, of Silent Spring. But habitat destruction continues as fast as we can describe it, if not faster. Our compulsion to describe the problem, something we do really well, serves a purpose, especially for people who think there's no problem. But the people who need to hear it the most aren't hearing it. We're describing the problem to each other in lavish detail, which crowds out efforts to rethink our whole strategy. Are we doing anything other than lurching back and forth between describing the problem and then buckling the seatbelt on our feedback loop? I, for one, think I've heard enough bad things about corporations, and I'm pretty tired of working on campaigns that will not only fail, but fail in a predictable way. How have we been colonized? Let me count the ways. We interpret failures as signals to do the same thing over again. We are predictable. Our strategies and styles of organizing fracture and dilute our resources. We either accept this dilution as inevitable or blame each other for not organizing right. We censor ourselves in thought and action. We act as though if we describe the problem to each other enough, it might go away. And now we can argue about whether we've been colonized or not. Corporate management is popping extra popcorn for this one. But enough of what we do. What do corporations do? The question should be, what do people do behind the fiction of corporations? One of the signs of our being colonized is that we personify corporations. I've been trying to avoid that in this piece, but help, I've been colonized and I need help getting up. Corporate management figured out 100 years ago that fighting against each other, competing and diluting their resources was weakening them and limiting their power. So they don't do that anymore. So what do people do hiding behind the corporate shield? The short version is that they write a script for us and we follow it. Then they write a script for themselves and we don't even read it. A big part of the script written for us involves regulatory law, including environmental and administrative law. It assumes that corporations have the rights of constitutional persons. It outlines procedures for what we the people can do, not much, what government can do, a little more, and what corporations can do, a lot. At regulatory agencies, corporate, quote, persons, that is, corporations, have constitutional rights to due process and equal protection that human persons, affected citizens, do not have. For non-corporate human citizens, there's a democracy theme park where we can pull levers on voting machines and talk into microphones at hearings. But don't worry, they're not connected to anything and nobody's listening except us. What regulatory law regulates is citizen input, not corporate behavior. So when we cooperate in regulatory law proceedings, we are following the script that corporate representatives wrote for us. We're either colonized or we're collaborators. That the regulatory agencies fail to protect the public is clear. Why they fail is another matter. One reason is they were set up with the cooperation of, and sometimes at the urging of, big corporations. Today, regulatory agencies and trade associations work together to do the work that trusts of the last century were set up to do. A second reason for regulatory failure concerns the nature of corporations, to which we turn briefly. Corporations are not natural entities, like Karner blue butterflies or white pines. Corporations are artificial creations that are set up by state corporation codes. These state laws, plus a bunch of court cases, form the basis for the notion that corporations have powers and rights. This law is defining law. This law is a script that corporate lawyers write for corporations. This law is the law that we don't even read. It's right there in the law books in black and white. Just like the regs we spend so much time on. But this defining law is invisible to us because we've been colonized and have accepted it as a given. We leave this defining law in corporation codes, bankruptcy law, insurance law, etc., to corporation lawyers who rewrite it every few years without so much as a whimper from citizen activists. Then we wonder why the parts per million regulations aren't enforced. So, the second reason the regulatory agencies fail to protect the public is that we have allowed corporate lawyers to write the defining law of corporations. This law bestows upon corporations powers and rights that exceed those of human persons and sometimes of government as well. It seems pretty obvious, then, that we need to rewrite the defining law. Sooner or later, we come up against the claim that all this stuff about rights and so on is just too legalistic. None of us wants to be involved in narrow and excessively legalistic strategies. However, a glance through any Earth First journal will confirm that we're constantly dealing with the law, whether we're filing testimony or engaged in direct action. As long as we're in the legal arena, we might as well be dealing with defining law and not the regulatory frou-frou that we've allowed to distract us. If the civil rights movement had been afraid to touch the deep defining law of the land, we'd still be laboring under separate but equal. For as long as we stick with regulatory law and leave defining law to corporate lawyers, we'll have corporate government. What are we going to do tomorrow morning? We could keep doing what hasn't worked in case it works next time. We could denounce people who suggest that what we're doing isn't working. Or we could declare victory so our folks won't get so depressed and discouraged. I'd like to steer clear of these options. I'd like to avoid negotiating with corporations as though they were persons with a role in a democratic system, and avoid doing anything that accepts that corporations have the constitutional rights of human persons. Here is one cluster of ideas for rewriting the defining law of corporations. It's not a 3-point plan, and it's not the beginning of a 20-point plan, just some ideas to think about. 1. Prohibit corporations from owning stock in other corporations. Owning stock in other corporations enables corporations to control huge markets and shift responsibility, liability, resources, assets, and taxes back and forth among parent corporations, subsidiaries, and other members of their unholy families. By defining corporations in such a way to prohibit such ownership, much of the antitrust regulatory law becomes unnecessary and superfluous. 2. Prohibit corporations from being able to choose when to go out of business. In legalese, no voluntary dissolution. This would prevent corporations from dissolving themselves when it came time to pay taxes, repay government loans, pay creditors, pay pensions, pay for health care, and pay for toxic cleanups. 3. Make stockholders liable for corporations' debts. People who want to be stockholders would reallocate their resources to corporations that they know something about, that weren't engaged in risky, toxic projects. This would encourage local, sustainable businesses and healthy local economies. Imagine that. These 3 measures might seem unrealistic to some, but it beats the heck out of a voluntary code of conduct or a wasted decade at a regulatory agency. All three of these provisions were once common features of state corporation codes. No wonder corporate apologists prefer we hang around in the regulatory agencies with our heads spinning with parts per million and habitat conservation plans. These three measures were quite effective, which is why corporation lawyers worked so hard to get rid of them. But they address only a tiny portion of what needs to be done. Here's another cluster of ideas for ways to shape a democratic process that is about people. The idea that corporations have rights would seem nonsensical to any but a colonized mind. 1. No corporate participation in the democratic process. Democracy is for and about human beings. Corporations should be prohibited from paying for any political advertisements, making any campaign contributions, or seeking to influence the democratic process in any way. 2. Corporations have no constitutional rights. A corporation is an artificial creation set up to serve a public need, not an independent entity with intrinsic rights. 3. Corporations should be prohibited from making any civic, charitable, or educational donations. Such donations are used to warp the entire social and economic fabric of society and make people afraid to speak out against corporations. These probably seem even more unrealistic than the first batch. Imagine how good it is for corporate executives that we find these ideas impractical. And by the way, these were all once law, too. The final objection to be raised is that we'll never get anywhere so long as the news media are against us, refuse to cover our issues, and distort our views. Agreed. But the news media are corporations, key players in a system of propaganda that encompasses not only television, radio, and newspapers, but also the entire educational system. The airwaves belong to the public. Why have we allowed a puppet federal agency to lease the public airwaves to huge corporations? You want to lock down? Lock down to a TV or radio station and make the public airwaves public again. Not for a day, but for a lifetime. You like boycotts? What if a regulatory agency gave a hearing and nobody came? The outcome would be the same, but we wouldn't have wasted all the time and resources. Nor would we have helped grant an aura of legitimacy to a sham proceeding. What could we do instead? We could get together with the lawyer and the expert and begin to figure out how to stop being collaborators. And that was an article titled, "Help, I've been colonized and I can't get up. Take a lawyer and an expert to a hearing and call me in a decade," by Jane Ann Morris, from the book Define Corporations, Defining Democracy, a book of history and strategy, which we will continue next week. Happy New Year, and thank you for listening to another episode of Unwelcome Guests. You can download this and all previous episodes on the web at unwelcomeguests.org.
Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end, for my guns and my saddle.